2,000 miles called Waxing Home One. Let's jump in and hear more from Erin, my interview with her, and more of her music.
A lot of my work in the late 2010s were, you know, was experimenting with musicians doing many things in addition to just performing their instruments and making sound. And a lot of those kind of theatrical forays were using voice, regular voices, or voices that were singing but not necessarily, you know, build trained singers, using the space and the stage to develop character and develop, you know, these sort of narrative driven pieces that involved 4-5 people on stage, for example, doing different functions and being different characters and contributing to an extra layer beyond just the sonic layer. And I felt really excited about that work. That's one of the examples I gave you, the Camerton on View example. But I also feel like I reached a limit with it where I found it interesting. So at some point I've backed off of that, and a lot of my work recently is more back to just sonic exploration. And I don't know that that's to say that it isn't viable in music, but for my own interest and sake, I found the point at which that reached, you know, that reached the right point for me, and I decided to start stepping back from it.
I find that question so interesting, because I tell people a lot of times, if you're going to go see even mainstream classical, but especially experimental classical, contemporary classical, whatever, like I tell people, the art form is inherently theatrical just in and of itself. You know, I mean, to listen to some of this stuff just at home on an MP3, if you're not trained, you're probably not going to really respond to it. You know, the extended techniques, all of that, you know, but if you think about it in a theatrical way, I think that helps. But audiences do that no matter what. They put a story onto, your music is the framework, and they put a story onto it. So I find it interesting when a composer decides to sort of control that narrative in a way. And I mean, and how full blown were you going, like, with the, you know, the piece that you sent? I mean, what was there a narrative, or were there just, like you said, roles?
There are roles, but also there is an overarching narrative that I think kind of peaks in the climactic point of this aria that is sung by the actual singer in the piece, of that piece anyway. And I think that it's not even controlling 100% of it. The the most important thing is that the piece sounds good and that the sounds are interesting and that it moves formally and develops sonically. But inside of that, there's also space for the performers to connect with each other at times. And audiences see that connection when they look at each other, when they are speaking, sort of breaking that fourth wall, maybe, giving just directions, stage directions on, a type of movement or even just costuming in some ways. But to your point of music already being inherently theatrical, I totally agree. And maybe that's why it's a fun thing to experiment with, because already watching five players on the stage just looking at their stands and playing music is interesting enough, at least for me. Like, I find that to be already exciting for the most part. And so when you add little things in there that, create other possibilities of things that are going on, it can just add to that. It also isn't like sketch theater or something like that, where if musicians aren't doing something, there's this kind of strangeness and self-consciousness. I think in music, if a musician is staring at their stand with their instrument, it's already an intentional default position that's understood. So, adding things here and there tend to be additive, as opposed to sort of having to sort of reinvent the wheel with every action that they're doing being somehow choreographed. I usually start with the bass of they're already playing. What's the thing that could look really interesting if the violinist here is having a solo on the right-hand side of the stage? Maybe the cellist looks away, and that implies a message, something like basic like that. Those types of things are like small actions that I think were fun to experiment with in some of these pieces.
Live in three. In one. Control room A440, please.
Bubblegum, bubblegum, bubblegum. Bubblegum,
Sarah, positions. Jennifer, be yourself, please. 10 seconds. Big breath, ladies. Live in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Hot Takes. Some cute kittens.
Pretty cool cats.
Whoa.
Pump pussies.
Bad bitches. I flew the plane.
She flew the plane.
You shouldn't laugh.
Let's talk about your sex quartet, New Threads. Tell me about the group. Tell me, you know, the mission of New Threads, how you got involved, and then we'll talk about your piece.
Yeah, New Thread started in 2011. It was the second major chamber group that I was sort of on the founding level for. And the idea was that I got together with the original member, Jeffrey Landman, who was also a New York-based saxophonist. And we thought, you know, there are a lot of sax quartets in the U.S., especially, and Prism frequents New York, though they're kind of primarily based in Philly. And we thought it would be nice to have a sax quartet doing new music in New York City as a mission, as a primary mission. And the reason we wanted to do that is because we knew so many really interesting composers that were writing music and coming out of some of the institutions here, but a lot who had moved to New York just because of the scene. So we wanted to feature those voices, and you know, some of the more established composer voices were writing quartets outside of you know, for other groups outside of New York, but we really wanted to sort of hit the street level folks that were getting going out, you know, with their careers, emerging composers, and feature those folks in new music for saxophone quartets. So we started commissioning right away. Our first commission, I think, was Richard Carrick, who wrote a fantastic piece early on for New Thread. And actually, it's a sax quartet. Getting off the ground in the city was pretty easy. We were asked to play a lot. And the model for the group was already pretty built in. I mean, everybody knew what a sax quartet was for the most part, or had seen one. And you know, we actually experienced a lot of bookings early on. One thing that happened, though, is we, because of the amount we were performing, we fell a little away from the commissioning aspect for a few years and weren't kind of playing the music that we that we really wanted to be playing, like premiering and doing. So we started a series called the Exploration Series. And that was one concert every year in New York City that would feature all new compositions for sax quartet. And we would either find new folks to write for us, commission them. People would submit music to us online. We have always had an open submission policy with the group. And we started anywhere from 4 to 5 pieces every year was just part of this series. There'd be good recordings after, and we're now in our 7th year of the Exploration Series. So it's actually been a really, really successful annual series, and we get to kind of form our season around it. Originally it was Jeff Landman, Kristen McKee and Justin Marks and myself. And since then we've had some turnover with membership. Zach Hirschen plays baritone now. And then on the alto is Noah Evan and soprano is Jonathan Halting-Cohen. And I play tenor. So we have a really solid group now that's really committed to continuing this mission of commissioning and also of premiering in New York. So our next concert is coming up on September 14th. And that will be at the Domena Center in the Benzigan Hall, where saxophones sound really great. So this group has a busy season, and we're looking forward to many more.
Yeah, tell me about Foliage then, the piece that you wrote for New Threads.
Yeah, Foliage was sort of a, when Noah Evan, who joined the group as recently as 2 years ago, came on board, I wanted to write a new piece for the group because I hadn't written for New Thread in probably 5 or 6 years. And so this piece was an exploration in, I mean, the title is obviously about leaves and different ways that, you know, not leaves make sound in a literal way, but that one might experience, you know, piles of leaves versus a single leaf versus a very, a leaf in spring versus a leaf in fall. And I think what I wanted to do with this piece was stack and create as much sound as possible in certain areas. So it's, you know, there's points in which you've got almost all four instruments playing multiphonics and then creating these gestural or vector-like movements out of the multiphonics, where we've got, a very, very extreme crescendos along with maybe bends in other instruments that sort of create sort of a bending of space-time effect. And I wanted to do everything acoustically. So the piece Foliage is acoustic. It plays with extremes of dynamics. So in addition to all four instruments playing multiphonics at fortissimo, there are moments where it's the softest possible pitch that's almost a whisper tone in the soprano for kind of a blocked extended period of time. And that plays a little bit with balance of form and momentum. So Foliage, we premiered it last September. And then in this past spring, I wrote a companion piece called Fledge, which is sort of the electronic version of Foliage that is more durational and takes a lot of the recordings from Foliage and creates sort of a fixed media track that's then triggered throughout the piece. So it's sort of a reimagining of the same piece, but in an electric or electronic context.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your solo album, 2000 Miles. So were these pieces that you had written and you wanted to put them together in an album, or did you write this album basically? Like, did it all mean to hang together as an album from the beginning?
Yeah, I knew I was going to do another album. It's my second solo album. My first album was only about 35 minutes of material and three tracks, and each one played with a different kind of a concept that I was toying with. So, I mean, you can almost think of them as etudes in a way. The first track was playing a lot with this basing an entire piece around a soprano multiphonic. The second track, and this is the original album, Dawn Treader, was playing a lot with resonance, sympathetic resonance in the room. I had a bunch of cymbals set up, and soft multiphonics and drone-like textures. And then the third was multiphonics, basically creating phrase lines, so mapping multiphonics, pitting them against each other and together to create sort of bigger, again, bigger vertical space, more sort of polyphony in the moment, but then also moving from one multiphonic to the next and trying to create these like actual, in some ways, melodic and harmonic lines. And so the second album, 2000 Miles, which came out, I think it was released 2 years later. I think it was 2021 because Dawn Treader was 2019. I wanted to sort of stick with this, the idea of finding and exploiting techniques. And so one thing I played a lot with was the tenor with no mouthpiece and a hot amplification. So I'll just stick a microphone right into the bell of the instrument and then create a resonant chamber with the saxophone that can like hot mic percussion and that can react to air sound and a lot of the small sounds. So the Angel Face, which is the I think it's the third piece on 2000 Miles, is an entirely exploration in that. And there's moments where you're, where you'll hear key clicks moving very quickly, in addition to like a very, very quick double tongue, that kind of sound, and air on top of that in a way that creates just this this granular texture that's so fast that I wouldn't be able to accomplish if I was only doing one of those three things, or in a traditional way if I was activating a reed. So that was a whole sound world I wanted to explore. And then some of the other sound worlds, for example, North Star is a soprano saxophone, played at very high high pitches, high enough where the highest my vocal cords can reach in a sort of screaming way match with the pitch in almost a like one-to-one way, and create this alchemy between the high voice and the soprano sax. And when I'm playing a high note on the soprano sax and also screaming, it doesn't sound like I'm screaming, and it also doesn't sound like I'm singing. It is a different kind of sound that melds with the pitch that's being created by the reed and the body of the horn. And in doing that, adds this like shimmer or texture to the pitch that's almost otherworldly. And if I, you know, gliss my voice up or gliss it down or take the note and change it while I'm continuing maybe a suspended kind of pitch in the scream, it can create all sorts of interesting gestures and vectors. And so North Star is an exploration in that, not just an exploration in doing it, but like also trying to create interesting forms out of some of these sounds that might, you know, seemingly be extended techniques that are used, you know, in novel ways. I'm trying to actually create pieces and create, you know, formal narrative with these techniques. And I think both of the solo albums attempt to do that. I want to be able to be a songwriter in a way with these techniques, or create real pieces, not just kind of blast and then finish. you know what I mean? Not to short sell that either, but, and then you'll hear there's a couple other tracks in there where I'm exploring tenor trills and different ranges of the tenor, and then another one that's basically back to soprano work around one multiphonic. So each one's very different, and they're all kind of, like I said, more like almost like explorations in a particular sound world. it could really damage things. But I mean, there's a reason that not everybody does it. It's not the healthiest thing to be doing. The vocal nodes or whatever you can develop with that kind of stuff. But also it's I think it's fun to try just about anything. There's some physical demands in some of the pieces that I play pretty regularly that I have to keep myself in shape for, you know, more than just my face in shape.
Well, that's just it. I mean, you know, people talk a lot about sonic exploration and you know, it's what we all do to a certain extent, you know, some of us more than others, or it's a focus for some of us more than others. But for you, when you're sonically exploring, your body is involved, right? I mean, there's a physicality to it. I mean, not only are you producing breath through this instrument, but you're also screaming, singing. And that's very different than, say, manipulating electronic elements. You have this sort of physical investment in the piece, if that makes sense, you know. And so to me, it just feels like a much more, I mean, this word is overused, but it literally is the case in this sense, visceral kind of investment in the music that you're making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that kind of loops back to what we're talking about with AI earlier. I always think that there's something interesting about watching a human body, regardless of, you know, what they're doing. It's a human, and because we're all human, we understand these limitations, and we understand certain to look for certain things and you know, it just identify certain things in performers. You can tell when someone's uncomfortable, you can tell when somebody's really tired, when they're sweating, or, you know, there's all these indicators, and those are interesting things in performance. And I'm so like enthralled with humans and the performance. I love like electronic music too, but especially human performance and the limitations of human performance, the mistakes of humans, the just honest humanness of humans. And that's where I think the future of humans in art exists. It's really by being human and being ourselves, not trying to match perfection or trying to be, you know, something, obviously trying to stretch limits in a, you know, in some cases in Olympic ways. But I think that's, it's so inspiring to watch musicians, you know, perform, feel things, and especially when you feel like it's a real honest and human reaction. And so with some of this stuff that I perform, I want to be able to reach higher. I want to be able to play louder. And sometimes, you know, the energy's not there, something's not there to do so. And it's in those moments where, you know, you have to make those decisions. And sometimes it reads to the audience, you know, why I'm backing down off this point. And other times it also adds to the sort of drama of the performance. And it also adds to the narrative of this being like an instrument where you put all your breath into it and all of your energy. So yeah, I think it's interesting, and I think it's fun to play with limits on stage and to be honest with the audience in a lot of cases about those, just through showing it, through performing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was the problem that DC Comics have with Superman. He had almost no limits. So not a very interesting character, right? I mean, our limitations are what make us interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Pope Bama. Talk about the project, and let's talk about the piece that we're going to, the piece that we're going to feature.
Sure. So Pope Bama basically started in 2016. Dennis Sullivan and I, Dennis is a percussionist composer and a very adept at electronics. And we started making sounds together, performing and writing music for a duo, both of us. And the pieces were like a sort of a hyper workshop situation where parts of a score were brought in and completely changed and then reworked, and things were added at a rate where wouldn't necessarily follow like formal ensemble workshops. It was very organic and very much about finding the newest sounds and pushing performance to the limit. Performance meaning not just on their instruments, but with text, with all of our limbs controlling as many different electronics as we can. We've been doing a lot of pieces that involve what we call performative electronics, where there are many different elements that are being controlled on stage. We often have a lot of stage mixers. We have a lot of FX pedals and a lot of triggers, MIDI triggers, and things like that that you know, create extra palettes in addition to our duo and our instruments that we're playing. So that ensemble sort of thrives on, so these new sounds and creating pieces around these new setups and sounds. And Basket Case is the second kind of piece that I've written for Pope Bauma, front to end. And it sparked from the idea of, well, first of all, we were improvising together, Dennis and I, and I asked if he wouldn't mind improvising using this analog synth that he'd acquired recently so that I could try to play soprano sax with the electric, very, very basic analog synthetic sound. And I couldn't find a way into that world. The improvisation felt really strange to me. It felt like that it was a very hard meshing of two worlds. And so Basket Case became sort of a challenge to write for analog synth and soprano saxophone and use every possible tool at my disposal to create some sort of sound world that works together. So I amplified the soprano saxophone, added a ring mod effects pedal to it, and used a set of multiphonics, found sort of complementary sounds in the analog synth that could be programmed to a point where they would match well with the soprano, and then sort of orchestrate a piece around that. So in addition to this analog synth, Dennis is also playing some percussion. There's a drum fill. I mean, the piece itself is basically inspired by Green Day's Dookie, if you know that album from the early 90s. The drum fill, or the song Basket Case, has a drum fill that Dennis plays at the end in a way that it sort of builds from this electronic big world to the point of just like straight snare drum and cymbal. And when we were on a road trip one day, and I realized that Dennis knew all the drum fills to all these 90s tunes that were, you know, we all grew up with. So I thought, well, this would be a fun way to sort of feature that and then also add all of these other components in it. Sometimes we're singing little lines from the song. For the most part, that piece is just an exploration. And again, performative electronics and like balancing acoustic and electronic sounds to create sort of one sound world.
Wow. That was great. That's a really great description of the project and the piece. And just, yeah. And I love that Dennis has all that in his head.
I don't think it'll ever go away. I think it's there.
it's just there forever.
Yeah.
The way the alphabet is in mine.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to Aaron Rodgers for being a guest on the program today. And Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit with the mission of providing equitable access to the transformative power of music making. To find out more, visit acmusic.org. On behalf of Relevant Tones, I'm Seth Bosted. Thank you so much for listening.